Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 16, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Got two guests scheduled for tonight. First, in a few minutes, about 10 after or so, we'll be speaking with Rita Shera, the public opinion scholar who is a fellow at the Century Foundation, about George Bush's polls and what, if anything, they mean. He's way down in the mid-30s now, approval rating. He's got more people who strongly disapprove of him than people who approve of him with any level of intensity, which is a pretty unusual situation in the world of polling. And actually, Bush's position in the poll approval ratings is quite low for a second-term president who is a year into his second term, a little over a year into his second term. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Christian Parenti, a peripatetic globe-trotting journalist who spent the month of February in Afghanistan, and he wrote it up in, I think, last week's issue of The Nation magazine, and I'll talk to him about that and also get his thoughts on the civil war, or what looks like a blooming civil war in Iraq, a country he also spent many months in reporting about. Some of the economic headlines in a moment, but interesting developments in Ecuador. Indigenous groups in Ecuador have begun a fourth day of protests against a proposed free trade deal with the U.S., blocking roads across the Andean highlands. This has been a source of major trouble in the Andean region. Ecuador governments have fallen many times, mainly led by the indigenous nationalities of Ecuador, the Confederation of the Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador. There's a lot going on in Latin America. Big political shift, big rejection of neoliberalism with varying degrees of intensity in Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador. Much going on down there, and tend to cover that closely in the coming weeks and months. Turning, however, to the belly of the beast, the U.S. economy, this morning reported by the Labor Department that first-time applications for unemployment insurance, the weekly jobless claims numbers, people who've just lost their jobs and have head over to unemployment insurance to sign up for benefits, up a surprising 5,000 last week, 309,000, the third consecutive increase, and what it looks like the fifth out of the last 6 weeks. So after taking a long, long decline from September through the early part of 2005, it has been inching higher. And it's certainly, it's at the lower end of the historical range, but still, I think the job market is really kind of peaking out, and hadn't really performed very well throughout this expansion, but it does even seem to be losing some of the little steam that it had. Although the February employment report released last Friday showed employers adding 243,000 jobs in February, above people's expectations, following upon a rather weak performance in January. This, by the recent standards, is a strong number, but by long-term historical standards, only a so-so number. And under the surface of the headline numbers, not such a strong appearance. The number of the share of industries, for example, adding employment was only 60%, poor number by historical standards. In earlier expansions, we'd see 70 or 80% of industries adding employment that were greatly underperforming the historical average. The average work week fell by a tenth of an hour, and really at the low end of its range. That is based on a survey of employers. The corresponding survey of households, which is where the more familiar unemployment numbers come from, didn't match the establishment surveys, the employer survey strength at all. We're seeing some stagnation in that measure. So the only bright spot was that average hourly earnings were up about 0.3%, following a 0.4% rise the previous month. That's not quite keeping pace with inflation, but it's considerably better than we saw for much of last year. And this is likely to alarm some of the more hawkish members of the Federal Reserve and people on Wall Street who are always worried about wages rising, leading to crimped profits and rising inflation. So this may tend to may inspire the Federal Reserve to be more tightened more than it otherwise would. That is, push interest rates higher in the hope of slowing down the economy. So this will be the big drama in the coming months. Are workers getting a little bit too much of the pie for the taste of the owning classes? Retail sales in the month of February off 2.3%, but that was, I'm sorry, off 1.3% after rising very sharp 2.3% in the month of January. January was favored by warm weather. February something of a payback for that warm weather. But it does show the U.S. consumer is still spending money that he or she doesn't necessarily have. That's the good old American way, borrowing money, mainly against the value of housing, as I've said here many times. Not so much the old credit card method, but people tapping their home equity, taking cash out of it. And that's been responsible for 40 to 50% of the growth in employment and incomes over the last several years, but that does seem to be running out of steam. The housing market now, several indicators that that is losing some steam. Applications for new mortgages falling last week and really in a downtrend that was started the second half of last year. And the National Association of Home Builders, which puts out a monthly housing market index, which is mainly a measure of the sentiment of home builders, that off a point in March, but also in a downtrend that started the middle of last year. So that the housing market, which had been the dominant driver of the American economy over the last several years, now does seem to be losing some of that steam. So the adjustment, the big question in the coming weeks will be how much of an adjustment, just a little one, or is there a big smash-up on the way? That is not an easy question to answer, but we have just seen over the last several years, the most manic expansion, the most manic bull market in housing that we've had since good statistics began after the end of World War II. People just gave up speculating on stocks after the bull market fell apart and decided to speculate on houses instead. And house prices rising and rising and rising, and now out of the reach of many, many people. People taking out very adventurous and risky loans in order to afford the price of new houses. But that all does seem to be coming to a close now, and the big question will be, what next? So let's take a little musical break and while we get Rita Shera on the phone and have a little contemplation of George Bush, courtesy of Ministry.
We recognize our greatest security is found in the relentless pursuit of these cold-blooded killers. The front of the new war is here in America. We're fighting a war against evil.
And that, a little bit from Ministry's No W from the 2004 collection, Rock Against Bush, Volume 1. I'm not sure.
Hey, Ian, don't come in here for a while.
Oh, that wasn't supposed to come in here either. I'm not sure what those words said, but I don't think they like George W. Bush very much. And a large portion of the American public now not liking George Bush very much either. And the latest polls showing, I think Pew yesterday came out with a 33% approval rating. We've got the Gallup coming in with a 37 or so. So he's hovering around the mid-30s, give or take a few points. And that's pretty low by historical standards. So I thought it was time to give Rita Shera a call. Rita is a fellow of the Century Foundation and a close student of polls, publishes a weekly newsletter that reads the polls. Welcome to WBAI, Ree.
Yeah, good to be here.
So we've got the Bush approval ratings hovering between like 33 and 37, quite low by historical standards. How low is this for a president?
Well, it's generally, this is the real danger zone for an incumbent, to be under 40%. It's bad to be between 40 and 50, but it's downright terrible to be in the 30s. And once they get down in the 30s, they don't have much influence in Congress. Everybody worries in their own party. It gives a lot of confidence to people in the opposing party. And it's just generally bad, bad, bad. Now, you know, even worse than that, of course, is they get down into the 20s, which does happen from time to time. And he's not there yet, but, of course, he's moving in the right direction.
Well, at least in the Pew measure, he's not far from, he's 3 points from 20, or 4 points from 20.
No, so it's definitely within shouting distance.
And that Pew survey was interesting. They've asked people what one-word description they'd use to describe George Bush, and, what was it? Incompetent is the first, but idiot was also way up in the top of the list.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating. That's a really interesting exercise they do, and it's fun to look at how things have shifted over time in terms of the changes in the one-word descriptions. I mean, in May 2003, I'm just looking at these data now, the top one-word description was honest. 29% mentioned that. As you can imagine, honest isn't much farther down there now. That's been about cut in half. And we had only 8% saying he was an idiot in May 2003. And now we got idiot up at 21%. And incompetent, looking at this May 2003 list, I don't think was even mentioned by anybody, at least not enough to make the cut. And now, of course, it's the top one-word description at 29%. So I think this among many other reasons, suggests that people's patience with our beloved president is fast running out.
And I saw some pundit or pollster quoted recently, might have even been by you, that said that Bush is now reaching the status that Jimmy Carter had, which is that people just don't think he's up to the office. Is that the way you see things?
Yeah, I think that's definitely happening. I mean, that incompetent one-word measure is one thing. I think it might have been Gallup the other day who asked, do you or do you not think that Bush is competent to run the government or something like that, and you've got like 60% saying no. So there's a number of other measures like that, all of which show that people's faith in Bush's abilities just to get things done as head of the government has completely gone south.
And he used to get high marks for his personality, which mystifies me, but people liked him better, even if they didn't necessarily agree with his politics, but he's even losing in that area, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he's gone downhill in each and every aspect of that. I think there's hardly a one that's a positive one where he still gets a net positive rating. Even on being a strong leader, he's now in sort of net negative territory. It's close to split, but people don't even have much faith in that anymore. And then on things like, does he share your values? Does he care about people like you? Is he competent? And so on. Is he honest? Is he trustworthy? All of those are quite negative.
So who is driving this? I mean, he was never very popular among Democrats, but what about independents and Republicans? How's he faring among them?
Well, if you look at the approval ratings, and this will vary a little bit across polls, it appears like the primary driver has been a declining rating among independents. For example, Gallup had it declining year over year from 46% to 23%, exactly cut in half. And independents, I think in most polls, are coming in somewhere in the 20s on their Bush approval. And then Republicans, who used to be around 90% a year ago, are now down in the mid-70s. So that's the second thing driving it. Democrats are already so low that even though he's lost a few points off of that, that's not the primary driver. It's the losing the center of the electorate and then secondarily even members of his own party.
Now, he all along, or for much of his presidency, has been a very polarizing figure with wide gaps between Democratic and Republican approval ratings. So that's pretty wide by historical standards. Is that now?
Yeah, no, he's, insofar as we got data on this, I think he's the most polarizing president.
And what do we owe that to? I mean, why is he so polarizing?
Well, it's a good question. I think, certainly there are presidents who've done a bad job before. But it's, I think, been the case that even when presidents were doing a bad job, there's been a certain number of members or identifiers of the opposing party are willing to cut the president some slack. I think those people have disappeared. Now, if they don't like the president, there's nothing holding them back. And conversely, the only people who are likely to feel at all held back in terms of their views. In fact, to cut them an unusual amount of slack are going to be people who identify with the incumbent's party. So there's just been increasing alignment between people's general views of politics and their identification with the party and their views on particular issues and so on. There's a lot, there's a lot more uniformity to those views now than they used to. So when things turn against a president like this, we see the president's in a disproportionate way that's different than the past. The president's the people who identify with the president's party sticking with him, and everyone else bailing out, the other side bailing out en masse. So people are less cross-pressured in that sense than they once were.
Are what was once seen as his virtue now being seen as a vice? For example, is his what was once seen as resoluteness now seen as stubbornness?
That's definitely happened. Yes, yes. I mean, and you can see that in the decline of people believing he's a strong leader. I mean, he's certainly just as resolute as ever, I suppose. But you know, people just aren't putting the positive spin on it anymore. They now associate it more with continuing to do stuff they think is stupid rather than doing stuff that they think is smart or at least needs to be done.
And some of the pundit class has been saying that what he really needs is a Reagan-style reshuffling of personnel, bring in some more grown-ups and get rid of the ideologues around him. You know, get rid of Andy Cardin, replace him with someone else as chief of staff.
I think that leaves out the highly plausible hypothesis that he is, in fact, the ideologue in chief. I mean, it's not clear to me that he's doing the things that he's doing simply because there are people around him who believe this. I think he, in fact, himself believes this. And, in fact, there's a whole segment of the Republican Party who is unlikely to lose their leading role anytime soon, who mostly agree on all this stuff and mostly wanted to do all the stuff that he did. I think it's hard to move out of that situation fast. I mean, too many people would have to leave. Too many people would have to give up their influence. Too many people would have to defer to other segments of the party that are out of favor. I just don't see it being able to happen particularly quickly.
And is there any particular thing we can point to as driving the president's numbers down, or is it just an accumulation of things?
Well, it is an accumulation of things. There's a lot of things that are going wrong. Certainly, Iraq turning into this unbelievable, protracted mess where just, you know, every time you something mildly positive happens, it's quickly followed by, you know, many super violent incidents. And people have obviously lost patience with that. I think the miscalculation on the ports thing was pretty big. You know, this is the one area where he still had some credibility. He, you know, because of the kind of guy he is, can protect the country from terrorists, can safeguard homeland security. And then whatever the substantive merits of this, doing something seemingly in secret that, at least in the minds of most people in the public, put that security in danger, it's just amazing. I mean, and then sticking to it for a while, too, until finally, I guess, they managed to convince the United Arab Emirates to just withdraw. But the damage had been done by the time that occurred. So, I mean, partly it's hard to do good things when you don't have any good options. And this is, I think, the nature of the situation. They have very few good options and many bad options. So right now they're choosing among various bad options, and they're not necessarily making the right choices. But that's not to say that there are other choices that they could have done that would have made things that much dramatically different. Now they're just trying to avoid doing stupid things. But, again, it's hard to avoid doing stupid things when you have very few good choices.
Or when you're an idiot.
or when you're an idiot, as the American people are, you know, so perceptively noticing.
I'm speaking with Reed Teixeira, a fellow at the Century Foundation and a public opinion expert. Is this a normal course of events for a second-term president, or would a relatively recently reelected president generally be much higher in the polls than he is?
Generally would be much higher, yes. He's definitely, headed south much faster than a lot of these guys, most of them wind up their second term in a higher place than he is now. Now, that's not to say he couldn't come back, but you know, so far there's no particular sign of that.
Well, I think a lot of people forget this, but I looked at this chart myself and drew a little trend line that if you take it just the year after 9/11, if you bracket that period. This really is a continuation of what started as a fairly low approval rating and sort of trended downward a little bit every month. right? I mean, he aside from 9/11, he was never a terribly popular guy.
That's right. I mean, he was actually on the September 10th. I think there was a Gallup poll that had him in the low 50s or something, which is pretty bad for a just elected president that early in his first term. And then, of course, you got this massive spike in his approval rating up to 90 in a lot of polls. And I don't think he went below 80 in the Gallup poll until spring of the following year. But once he spiked up in September, he just kept on going down at a steady rate. Then he got a little bit of a spike, for example, from the Iraq invasion, but a much smaller one, and then he started going down. Actually, an interesting thing is if you look at the most recent approval ratings, he's going down. According to Charles Franklin, a political scientist who runs a very interesting website called Political Arithmetic, and he does trend analyses of all the different polls, not just one poll. His approval rating is now declining at a faster rate since the beginning of this year than it ever has before.
So you alluded to this earlier, but what precisely does this mean? Some people are saying, well, this is all very nice, but he's still pretty much getting his way. He gets his Supreme Court appointments. He's going to probably get his tax cuts extended. He's going to win in a lot of the things he thinks are very significant. Does this matter, or can he just sort of push his way through for another 3 years and do pretty much what he wants to?
Well, I think his ability to get things done while it still is not trivial is already being hemmed in by his lack of popularity. Now, the thing that will really put the most sand in the gears, though, is if the Republicans are dealt a fairly stern setback in November of this year.
Which sets up my next question. The Wall Street Journal poll, I think, that came out this morning, Wall Street Journal NBC poll that came out this morning, showed the Democratic Party as a party with an approval rating lower than Bush's. So are the Democrats really gaining from Bush's distress?
Well, it varies by poll whether the Democrats actually have higher favorability than the Republicans. There's some evidence. If you look across polls, by and large, the Democrats' favorability is increasing relative to the Republicans. Now, that said, it's still not the case that their favorability on average is that much higher than the Republicans at this point. They don't seem to be reaping as great an advantage in that respect as you might think they would, given what's going on. However, if you look at other things like the generic congressional ballot, it's clear that people, whatever their reservations about the Democrats might be, that when they're asked how they plan to vote in November, they're leaning pretty heavily toward the Democrats. The most recent Gallup poll, I think, had them up by 16 among registered voters, had the Democrats up by 16 among registered voters. A lot of other polls are showing these kinds of leads in the double digits. And this is basically a pretty good sign for the Democrats, even if taking into account the Democrats typically don't do as well on election day as they do among registered voters as a whole. But 16 points is still 16 points. So, you know, there's a lot of debate about, well, okay, I mean, can the Democrats really hold on to that kind of generic advantage unless they open up a much wider lead on favorability and actually give people something positive to hold on to that they stand for?
Yeah,
and it's an interesting debate, but it's sort of hard to resolve just looking at the data we have.
It'd be very hard to summarize the Democrats, as they used to say in the 20s, their unique selling proposition, the ad buzzword from the 1920s. It's very hard to say what that would be for the Democratic Party. What exactly do they stand for? What is their message? What is their policy position?
Right. That is a fair point, and we do know from looking at other data that if you ask people, do the Democrats have a clear ideas for solving the country's problems in general? If you ask them about Iraq, you get pretty lopsided majorities saying the Democrats, in fact, don't have a clear plan for solving problems for dealing with Iraq and so on. So they don't have an advantage over the Republicans in that respect. But the question then has to be asked, you know, how important is it for them to clear that up? I mean, an off-year congressional election is different than a presidential election, where I think that sense that people don't know what you stand for is more likely to hurt you, and you have to be much more specific about what you stand for as a presidential candidate. I think in an off-year election running against an unpopular incumbent party, you don't have to be as specific as you do in a presidential campaign, but it can still be argued that you need, nevertheless, that 25 words that summarizes what you do stand for, that sort of leverages off what people don't like about the incumbent administration, all the negative things they feel about them, the corruption, the incompetence, and so on. What's the Democrats' 25 words about that? I mean, it should be something like honesty at home, respected abroad, or something like that. You know, that's directly connected to the feelings people have about the incumbent administration. I mean, we don't even have that, I don't think, for the Democrats at this point, unless you count the infamous slogan, "We can together, we can do better,"
yes.
Which is, I think, as far as they've gotten in specifying what they're for.
That's kind of a truism. We can all do better. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the agent of that doing better. What about Russ Feingold's censure motion? Most of the Democratic Party has been running away from that. I think you got a co-sponsor in Tom Harkin, but there's some of the Republicans are licking their chops. The Wall Street Journal had an editorial yesterday, for example, saying this gives the Republicans a great opportunity basically to accuse the Democrats of being traitors and soft on the enemy.
Right, and there's a story, I believe, in the Times today, about New York Times, about how the Republicans were seeking to capitalize on this alleged political mistake. I don't know. I think in the end it's not going to matter that much. I don't think I think if the Democrats did all hop on that bandwagon, it would probably not be on balance a good thing, because it would leave them too vulnerable. Kind of switch the subject to should Bush be censored or not, away from all his obvious misdeeds and problems with the administration. But I think Feingold and a few other people saying it is just sort of, you know, it's not going to dominate the debate. I think the Republicans are hoping they can goad a lot of people into making this an issue, and of course try to goad the press into making it an issue. If you can get the press to cover the debate about whether Bush should be censored as opposed to all this other stuff, then that's good. But I don't think, you know, I think this is going to be a pretty minor league phenomenon myself.
I saw, I think it was David Brooks on the TV about a year ago, and he said something to the effect that for the president, it's still September 12th, but the rest of us have moved on.
Good line.
Is that a fair diagnosis of public opinion now?
Well, I think the public a year ago might not have felt that way, but I think they're really starting to get there. I mean, I think this gets back to the thing we were discussing about how he just doesn't get it anymore. He's stubborn rather than resolute. He's not competent. He's not paying attention. All these things. I mean, I think the sense that Bush is stuck in the past is just sort of ideological in how he approaches things, has blinders on. I think that this is something many of us might have said a couple of years ago, but the public probably wasn't ready for it, but now they probably are.
Anything you can think of that would revive Bush's fortunes, or does he look pretty cooked here?
He looks pretty cooked, but, you know, never say never. I mean, if the economy just came back and, you know, sort of did a late 90s impersonation, perhaps that would help. Probably the thing that would help the most is if by some miracle Iraq suddenly calmed down and everybody loved each other and they were putting flowers in their, you know, their muskets or whatever.
Yeah,
I think that would help, but that seems highly unlikely.
That the delivery from the florists for all the American troops to get their flowers finally came through after much delay. Okay, well, thank you for joining us, Rui Teixeira. How can people find your Public Opinion Watch newsletter?
Well, Public Opinion Watch can be found in both the Century Foundation and the Center for American Progress websites, and of course you can see all that content and more on my weblog, Donkey Rising.
DonkeyRising.com?
EmergingDemocraticMajority.com.
EmergingDemocraticMajority.
Put Donkey Rising in Google, and I guarantee it'll come up.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Rui.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Rui Teixeira, who is a public opinion expert, whose institutional home is the Century Foundation. And let's take a little musical break and come back with Christian Parenti.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, understanding?
That was Nick Lowe, who was singing an old song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, in a live performance somewhere in 1996 on a radio station that now escapes me. A song made famous by Elvis Costello, but done in several versions, and that one rather mournful and heart-tugging. And unfortunately, Christian is now stuck downstairs at the intense security here at 120 Wall Street. Somebody has to go down to get him. I am going to I'll have to kill a little time here until he gets upstairs. This is all part of the post 9/11 mania. To get into this building, you need a picture ID. I don't know, in case somebody's going to come in and hold the National Community Development Loan Fund people hostage or something. I don't know, but utter madness of high security for no apparent purpose. But let's see if we can. What's happening here? Okay, I guess I have to talk a little more. What should I talk about? I got an email from someone earlier today about pensions in New Jersey, and Christy Todd Whitman solved the budget crisis many years ago, about 10 years ago now, in New Jersey, by borrowing heavily from the state pension fund and hoping that somebody else would take care of the problem further down the road. And apparently that today, or that tomorrow, now seems to be arriving. This is a fascinating aspect of life in America these days, is the shifting of risk from governments and companies to workers, and pensions are a very important focal point for that shifting of risk. It used to be that you'd get a pension of a fixed amount from an employer. Now it's all about your employer, if you're lucky, will make some contributions to a 401k or something, but what the size of the check depends upon your investment decisions and whether the stock market is doing well when you retire or not. George Bush likes to call this the ownership society, but it looks like it's a way to hand the working class an empty bag, and we'll be looking at this over the coming weeks. And now, finally, Christian, a veteran of many war zones, manages to breach the defenses of 120 Wall Street, which are very tight. It's like the checkpoints in Baghdad. Welcome to
much tighter than those checkpoints.
Welcome to Behind the News.
Thank you,
Christian. Before we talk about Afghanistan, the subject of that cover story in last week's issue of The Nation. So I want to get your thoughts on what's going on in Iraq now. Some debate over, you spent, maybe a cumulative total of about 3 months over there writing about it, writing a book about it.
4 months.
Writing a lot of articles about it. You haven't been there in a while, but I'm sure you're still following it very closely. What is the country breaking into civil war?
I mean, I would consider it civil war. It's not Lebanese-style civil war where everyone in every community at the height of the Lebanese civil war was forced to participate. And there were barricades in the streets, but I don't know what you would call this kind of body count to an intercommunal conflict other than civil war. I mean, it seems like it's becoming just a semantics, to try and justify the U.S. occupation to not call it civil war. It's if we lived under those conditions, we would call it civil war. You know, anyone who's ever used the term gang warfare about homicide in the U.S. certainly has to consider what's going on in Baghdad now. A type of civil war.
Well, it looks like 40 or 50 bodies are showing up every day.
What was it yesterday or today? It was 80 bodies.
Yeah. Who are the actors in this war? And there's some in the conspiracy community are saying that this is all the CIA or the Mossad's doing.
The conspiracy community. I like that.
Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that this is not good for the U.S. Certainly the U.S. pursued a policy, a classic colonial policy of divide and rule, but this is out of control and threatens the legitimacy of the occupations, threatens the sustainability of the occupation. So I think this is the result of basically just these two main factions of the Ba'ath, the remnants of the Ba'ath Party, which is one thing, you know, I always think that the left really underestimates the role of the Ba'ath Party, and everyone does. I mean, the right, too, right? But the Ba'ath Party on one hand, the Sunni elements of the Ba'ath Party, and the death squads being run by the various Shia parties, particularly out of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which controls the Interior Ministry. These seem to be the main antagonists going at each other and going at each other's respective communities, and I don't think it serves U.S. interests. I think that U.S. imperial interests are, you know, in deep crisis in Iraq, really deep crisis.
Yeah, it would seem to me that they would want a peaceful Iraq that was pumping oil and with a puppet government and that was friendly to U.S. permanent bases. And it doesn't seem like, well, they've got some bases there, but the rest of the picture seems very unpleasant if you're a war planner.
Yeah, very unpleasant. And they can't mobilize any more troops. They're having a recruitment crisis. They have basically a pro-Iranian theocracy in charge of Iraq that's refusing to share power with Sunnis or Kurds, the main Shia parties. They have within that Shia bloc, Sadr's followers have become increasingly powerful and now have the single largest bloc within this Shia bloc. So it hasn't worked out as they planned by any means. And
I was reading a piece.
I guess the subtext of what you're getting is, I mean, people need to remember that, like, even competent empires that do use devious means, like, sometimes mess up and there are tremendous errors and they lose.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people think the empire always gets things right, and something looks like it's going wrong. It was only all part of the grand plan from the beginning, and I'm sure. Well, I don't know whether Donald Rumsfeld wants us to think that, but I think it was David Brooks who has a column today denouncing Rummy, and quoting some of the punditry at the time of the beginning of the war, which is now 3 years ago. A lot of people, despite the bad reputation of the pundit class, a lot of people actually predicted precisely what turned out. It seems that anyone who knew anything about Iraq was warning of this sort of thing from the beginning, and no one wanted to listen.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've said this before on your show. It's all great historical blunders have this same element. Like, the Civil War in the U.S. started not because the ruling class in the South thought that maybe they'd fight a four-year war and then lose, and then slavery would be abolished, and they'd be put under military occupation, and black people would have political power. I mean, that was not part of their thinking. They attacked the North because they knew the North would fold. It was just obvious to them, but they were totally wrong. You know, World War One started the same way, and the reason that
over by Christmas, right?
Yeah, you know, and the reason this one started is because they knew that they were, you know, the neoconservatives knew they were right. They knew they could do this. They were absolutely convinced. They didn't need to see the facts. It happens. Ruling classes that are rational and devious sometimes become intoxicated by their own ideology and their own string of victories, and they overplay their hand. It's that simple, and that's clearly what's happened.
And we're learning from the New York Times this week, the excerpting of that book by Traynor and the other guy whose name escapes me now, that a lot of people were warning Rumsfeld at the time of the invasion that there are all these pockets of Saddam's Fayyadin are running around who could cause trouble in the future. And Rumsfeld just said, roll on to Baghdad and don't worry about these guys. So, you know, he's even warned at the time made some very, very bad decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, it's hard to read their minds, but is this hubris? Is it stupidity? Is it, how could they have made such a blunder on such a scale, which is doing more to damage U.S. imperial interests than anything, at least since the Vietnam War and maybe since the end of World War II?
Yeah, I think it's hubris and ideological intoxication, like fixation on ideas and spin, and the mass line, party line difference, where you got the party, the neoconservatives, start believing the mass line that they're selling to everyone else, and they forget that they need to have their own more cautious, private discourse, and they just believe the stuff they've been selling to all of us. That's what it seems like. And it's also happening in, I regret to report, Afghanistan.
Yeah, it seems almost like the last gasp of the high-tech bubble was Rumsfeld's fantasy that technology could win over messy human power in warfare. And, well, the NASDAQ disproved the civilian version of that, and the course of events in Iraq is disproving the military version of that. I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, who is the author of a cover story in the March 27 issue of The Nation, after result of his visit to Afghanistan, the previous war zone. And I think most people have kind of forgotten about Afghanistan. Most Americans have certainly forgotten about Afghanistan. And the absolute numbers on casualties are relatively low compared to Iraq, but it's still a risky place for American soldiers to be, right?
Yeah, the rate of casualties is the same. From time to time, averaged out, it's the same rate of casualties. The U.S. troop presence there has always been really low. And basically, you know, Afghanistan was a stepping stone to Iraq, and it has served as a prop in domestic political theater from the very beginning. And I think the only reason that they went and invaded Afghanistan was because it would have been too much to handle for them to go directly to Iraq. Nobody would have joined their coalition, and large parts of the American public would have not supported Iraq's invasion without first making some effort to go get Osama bin Laden. So they went in and they did Afghanistan. It also proved Donald Rumsfeld, for a moment, proved Donald Rumsfeld right, that you could do this stuff light, fast, and cheap, and with lots of technology instead of troops and casualties, labor. And interestingly, you know, the U.S. only had 9,000 troops in Afghanistan for the first 2 years, and as they say, the tooth-to-tail ratio for the U.S. military, kind of corny Pentagon lingo there, the number of support staff for every soldier in the field is about 10 to 1. So for the first year, they only had about a battalion of soldiers in the field at any one time, which is about 800 soldiers. And that was just... It's an indication of how limited their real commitment was to transforming that country into a democracy, et cetera, and all that. And so there really was, in some ways, it really was just like basically a half-hearted manhunt underway for Osama bin Laden on the eastern border with Pakistan. I think they would have loved to have found Osama bin Laden. I don't think they didn't find him because they want to have him out there. I think it would be
a tremendous political coup to find the guy, yeah. Or just his head or something, yeah. Some part of him.
Yeah, and so they basically were just basically running a really, really complicated manhunt that required, you know, like 10 people for every one person in the field to get the toilet paper to them on time, that sort of thing. And then what happened was they had, the first or the second year, they even forgot, the Republicans forgot to appropriate any money in their first budget proposal for Afghanistan, the country, for its development, rather than for the war. The Pentagon had money for the war, but there was no money appropriated for development. And then much to their shame, the Democrats called them out on that, and they changed it. But so then there was this Operation Anaconda, and they hit this wall. 2 years into the war, they hit this wall of very serious Taliban resistance, and only then did they start increasing troop levels. Then, through the parliamentary elections, they got troop levels in Afghanistan up to 19,000. They're now drawing them down, and to pick up the slack, the Europeans are stepping in and increasing their troop levels. So it will be about 50.
So this is now a NATO operation.
It's still like kind of. I mean, the U.S. is ultimately in control.
Well, the U.S. is in control of NATO, too, right?
Yeah, yeah. But it's increasingly...
But there's a fig leaf of multilateralism on this, at least.
Yeah, and there's a very big fig leaf in Afghanistan. What's happening politically... I mean, this is not what I talk about in the article. In the article, it's, you know, embedding U.S. troops and European troops and discussing their different counterinsurgency tactics and then meeting the Taliban and that sort of stuff. But what's happening, I think, at a grander scale in all this is that the Europeans think that they can step in to the generalized crisis of which Iraq is the central piece, and take the burden of Afghanistan off of the U.S. And
what do they get for this?
They would get, I think, all sorts of indirect benefits in trade negotiations, and they would get more cooperation and compliance and decency from U.S. governments that would realize that the U.S. runs the planet. But it needs partners to do that, and it can't run roughshod over the other rich economies. So, I mean, it's sort of an old-fashioned view of politics, but I think that's really how it works. If you can project military power, then you get, you get sort of political and economic rewards from that, and you know, the international arena. So the Europeans are doing this in Afghanistan.
Which Europeans exactly? We've got some Danes.
The British, or the bulk of it, and then not just the Europeans, Canadians, British, the Dutch have sent quite a few troops, and that's because they're so ashamed of Srebrenica. The commander who was under UN direction at Srebrenica was Dutch, and those were Dutch troops there where there was a massacre of several thousand civilians, and that guy could have opened fire on the Serbs and created an international incident and gotten NATO air support and avoided that. So the Dutch have to go. The Dutch military has to wash its honor. But then there's also Germans, there are Norwegians, there are Lithuanians, Spanish, like several hundred French special forces. But the main bulk of it are Canadians and Brits and Dutch.
And how, if at all, are they doing things differently for the Americans?
Well, they take the main thing, according to this one European intelligence officer that I spent some time with and got some papers from, is that, you know, they have, they basically have more practice fighting counterinsurgency, particularly the British. The British military has, I think, has lost people in action every single year since World War II, except for one. They've been fighting counterinsurgency for a long time. So, but the main thing is they have a method for incorporating the doctrine into their military practice. Whereas the U.S., you know, if you go online, you read these military journals, it seems like the U.S. military is thinking a lot about counterinsurgency, and there's a lively debate. But you actually meet the U.S. military in the field. They're not very good at the political side of counterinsurgency.
Yeah, what about that Dari anecdote?
In the article, lieutenant who was in charge of a platoon of MPs whose job it was to secure the Shamali plain around Bagram Air Base, which is mostly Tajik, but there are some Pashtun villages there, and Pashtun people in Afghanistan increasingly are supporting the Taliban, and they had been attacked recently. The base had been attacked, and then some of their patrols had been attacked, and I asked him, well, what's the ethnic makeup around here? And he said, Dari, and Dari's a language. It's not an ethnic group. And the guy had been there almost a year. I could not believe that. So that flies in the face of counterinsurgency doctrine, which is that you can't win a guerrilla war by military means. You have to build up an ethnographic knowledge of the place. You have to use economic and political methods to win the hearts and minds of the people and develop intelligence to precisely target military responses. So the U.S. is kind of ham-fisted about the political side of counterinsurgency. I mean, they're very, very aggressive, very, very well-trained, superb soldiers. No one doubts that when it comes to, like, dropping out of the sky and running through the mountains after the Taliban. But in terms of keeping, like, your average Pashtun father of a big family from wanting to pick up a gun or plant an IED, they're not very good at that. So the Europeans are more sensitive about that sort of stuff. But the problem is there's not enough money. I think their counterinsurgency efforts are going to fail, even though they're more sophisticated, because there's enough money for development. And Afghanistan is desperately poor. There are 24 million people who live there, the same as in Iraq. There has been very little real development. Only $8 billion has been spent. The World Bank director for Afghanistan described the built-in graft, just the decadence of the NGO sector there in Afghanistan as the worst he had ever seen. He called the corruption there sky high, 30-year-long career in this kind of work. And the main problem is that the Bush administration, in using Afghanistan as a political prop in its domestic, in its electioneering in the U.S., allowed these horrible warlords we've discussed before in this program, have written about in the nation before, into the government. And they now are ministers and parliamentarians, and they have immunity, and they're not going away, and they control the government, and they've shaped the government. So the government of Afghanistan is entirely dysfunctional. There are 32 ministries, that duplicate each other, which is a large number of ministries. Germany has, I think, about three times the population of Afghanistan, and it has like eight ministries, I was told. So it's just, you know, the government is a kleptocracy.
But I was reading, I think the revenue of the government is like $350 million a year, which is just working these numbers in the top of my head. It's about what the U.S. government takes in about 20 minutes. So this is all they have to work with in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It's just desperately poor, and it's a kleptocracy. It's just like mountainous version of Haiti.
Yeah. I mean, people literally pay to get jobs so that they can make money shaking folks down. I mean, people will pay money so that they can be a police commander. I mean, they don't even care about the $50 a month salary. They'll pay several hundred dollars a month to have the job so that they can run checkpoints where they extort people. That's how corrupt the government in Afghanistan is. So it's sort of too late in some ways.
And so what's up with the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban...
are they on the rebound?
They're on the rebound, and they've changed their tactics. They're using suicide bombing, which they're... had not been before in Afghanistan. And there is actually not a lot of outside of Iraq in the world. You know, if you actually do the numbers in Palestine, there's really, you know, there's suicide bombing like once every 2 months, maybe. And in the last 6 months, there have been 30 suicide bombings in Afghanistan. They've killed a Canadian diplomat. They've killed foreign soldiers, Afghan soldiers, and even in... foreshadowing of Iraq targeted civilians. So that's what's up with the Taliban. And I interviewed some Taliban fighters and a Taliban spokesman and some Afghan intelligence people. And it seems to me one of the key things that Americans don't know about the Taliban is that they're very clearly run out of Pakistan. And they have very substantial support from the Pakistani state. And I think that goes all the way up to Musharraf. There's a long...
But this is George Bush's great ally in the war on terror.
Yeah. And Musharraf, you really got to hand it to him. I mean, look what this guy's done. He comes to power in a coup d'etat. He has nuclear weapons. He's under intense economic sanctions and manages to completely rehabilitate himself and have the sanctions removed from his country, all by playing the indispensable ally, where he's, you know, fighting the Taliban from the other side of the border, when in fact his security forces run the Taliban, and occasionally they fight the Taliban, and they do have. Legitimate fights with their own in the tribal belt with Pashtun separatists, with various political Islamists.
I don't mean to demean your substantial reporting and analytical skills, but how can you know this and the U.S. government doesn't seem to?
I think that they
do they know it and they just don't want to?
I think they know it, and I mean, this is a good question. You know, I think it's basically like the answer to the questions all about this war lie in some form in Gabriel Kokel's book about Vietnam, Anatomy of a War, and that we need heavy doses of Weber along with our Marx to understand what's going on. That the bureaucracy is such, the officialdom's culture is such that everybody knows what's going on, but nobody wants to be the jerk that tells their superior the bad news and puts their superior in the position of having to pass on that bad news and ultimately getting up to the president. And every step along the way, the officialdom of the bureaucracy is given cues to be silent. And in other words, the officialdom of the bureaucracy propel their own careers by sacrificing the larger agenda of U.S. imperialism. So there's a contradiction between the interests of the people who work in the Pentagon, work in the embassy, even work in the White House, and what their stated goal is, which is essentially to run the world.
Well, we've only got like a minute left, but here's a big question for you to end on. Is the empire really in trouble?
I think one thing I learned in Afghanistan, I think it's in trouble, but like it's not going to collapse very quickly. The Europeans kept emphasizing this, and it was only in talking to them I really realized how enormous the U.S. military is and how even very powerful countries like France, that manages to be independent in many ways, are really, really always oriented towards the U.S. And the U.S. has so much political, economic, and military power that I don't think it is in imminent crisis of collapse, but it's going into some sort of phase of crisis. I mean, look at the very, very, very serious defeat it faced in Vietnam. less than 10 years later, it invaded Grenada. That was a serious defeat where soldiers were murdering their officers and refusing to go into combat, and the army fell apart, and the U.S. left in total humiliation, and they recovered from that. So I think that both, there will be a very serious defeat, a very serious setback, but that alone does not undo an empire of this size and ultimately sophistication.
All right. Thank you, Christian. I've been speaking with Christian Parenti, journalist, author of the book The Freedom, published a little while ago by the New Press, and of a cover story in The Nation, Afghanistan, The Other War, in the March 27th issue of The Nation. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. And after all this grim news, let's go out with a little bit of girl pop from The Sugar Babes, Red Dress. It's almost the weekend. Till next week. Bye.